In 1986, Kurt Vonnegut Jr. gave the Ware Lecture at the General Assembly of Unitarian Universalist Congregations. The lecture is always a highlight at General Assembly, and it has included, previous lecturers have included many highly notable people: Howard Thurman, Reinhold Niebuhr, Mae Sarton, Helen Caldicott, Holly Neer, Norman Lear, Alvin Toffler. He was in exalted company. And in typical Vonnegut style, he combined passion, humor, and irreverence to make his point. And his point was really quite simple. Vonnegut argued that Christianity had got it wrong, very wrong, when it settled on that commandment to love one another and to love our neighbors as ourselves. In his words now, love is simply too strong a word to be of much use in ordinary day-to-day relationships. Love is for Romeo and Juliet. I'm to love my neighbor? How can I do that when I'm not even speaking to my wife and kids? My wife said to me the other day, after a knock-down, drag-out fight about interior decoration, I don't love you anymore. And I said to her, so what else is new? She really didn't love me then, which was perfectly normal. She will love me some other time, I think. I hope. It's possible. If she had wanted to terminate the marriage, to carry it past the point of no return, she would have had to say, I don't respect you anymore. Now that would be terminal. I was tickled to read this because when I work with wedding couples who are planning to get married, and they go on and on about how much they love each other, and I'm always paying very close attention to how they interact to make sure that underlying that is a deep sense of respect for one another. And I point out to them that that's much more likely to get them through the challenging points in their marriage than the more ephemeral concept of love, which for most of us ebbs and flows over a lifetime. So Vonnegut argued for one small linguistic adjustment. And here again I quote, I like to think that Jesus said in Aramaic, ye shall respect one another. That would be a sign to me that he really wanted to help us here on earth and not just in the afterlife. Then again, he had no way of knowing what ludicrously high standards Hollywood was going to set for love. Now, of course, we could argue about the different words that get translated as love in the scriptures and the different ways that word is understood. We could differentiate between the Greek eros and philia and agape and what Jesus might actually have meant when he told his followers to love their neighbors and even their enemies. Because logically, of course, we know he wasn't talking about hearts and flowers kind of love for everyone you encounter. But Vonnegut's main point was that no matter what Jesus might have meant 2,000 years ago, when we hear this commandment now, most of us have certain assumptions about what it means to love another person. For most of us, that word carries an implication of some kind of affection or fond feelings. And given that we fail in loving even our nearest and dearest from time to time, we're bound to fail when we try to extend that kind of love universally to people we don't even know or like. And so maybe, he argued, we should shoot for something a little more manageable. It occurs to me that the Buddhist idea of cultivating a sense of loving kindness might bridge the gap here because it maintains a feeling of warmth. That idea of loving kindness is a warm feeling that somehow might be lacking in the idea of respect, but it doesn't carry the same expectation of fondness or affection that the verb love carries for most of us. But that would be a different sermon, and maybe I'll preach that one next time. So Vonnegut follows an interesting train of logic. He doesn't say it's wrong to try to love our neighbors. He just points out that most of the time we're really not able to do it. And he sees that as a serious problem, because when the bar is set too high and we inevitably fail to be as loving as we think we should be, then it's easy to start down a long continuum of emotions that quickly lead into negative territory. He says, if you can't love your neighbors, then you can at least like them. If you can't like them, you can at least not give a damn about them. If you can't ignore them, then you have to hate them, right? You've exhausted all the other possibilities. So he gives us this continuum of feelings or emotions that follow from this ideal of loving. If we don't manage to love, maybe we can like. If we can't manage to like, maybe we can be indifferent. And if we can't manage to be indifferent, obviously we're going to dislike or even hate other people. And he points out that that journey can happen very quickly. Even between the two friends in our story, lifelong friends, one little point of acrimony in their relationship made it very easy for that love to turn to a very negative kind of emotion. Fortunately, underlying all of that was a deeper respect they had developed over their lifetimes that allowed them eventually to bridge that gulf. Now, I'm not sure the ease with which we as human beings slip into that kind of dislike or hatred for others is a direct result of a failed attempt to love other people. Vonnegut was speaking specifically about the Christian world and community, and certainly the kind of hatred he's talking about is not limited to Christians. It seems to me perhaps it's more rooted in any religious tradition that has a very rigid understanding of right belief and wrong belief, which obviously some parts of Christianity hold, along with some parts of other traditions, and that sets up an in-group and an out-group and allows for that kind of quick slide from appreciation to dislike. But I'm still intrigued by the distinction he makes between love and respect. I struggle with this myself because over the years I have come to relate more and more deeply to the Christian tradition, and I now worship in a Mennonite congregation. And so I hear this language of loving your neighbor and loving your enemy all the time, and I struggle because I often don't feel loving. And it does seem to me that this idea of some kind of underlying respect is closer to the intention of what Jesus was trying to say with the stories that he told. It's quite easy when we can't manage to have warm feelings about a person or a group of people to make that leap that if I don't like them, I must dislike them. Focusing on respect instead of affectionate feelings changes the whole conversation, because it takes personal feelings out of the equation altogether and makes it easier to stay in relationship with other people, whether we like them or not. The liking ceases to be the point. Now, I want to share some words from the Reverend William Schultz. Bill Schultz is a past president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. In fact, he was president when Vonnegut gave his lecture. He also has served as the president of Amnesty International, and he's currently heading the UU Service Committee. And in a piece he wrote for the Unitarian Universalist World magazine during his presidency, he suggested that there are some lessons that we have learned very well as Unitarian Universalists and others that we have not learned so well. We have learned well that because each person is precious, we need to respect his or her individuality. So the individual thing, we're good at that. And secondly, we've learned that it's good and important to stand up for what you believe. We're good at voicing our opinions and taking a stand. He goes on to point out a couple of things we've failed to learn. And one of them is, and I quote, "Cherish our individuality as we do, we still have to build a world with those people across the road. We don't have to like the way they manifest their fear any more than they like the way that we manifest our righteousness. But like it or not, we have to build a world together." His words echo for me the reading from William Sloane Coffin, the idea that all people have more in common than they have in conflict, and that it's precisely when what they have in conflict seems overriding that what they have in common needs most to be affirmed. We live in a world filled with deep divisions and disagreements. We all know that. And it's fine to have vigorous debates about those disagreements. And as Bill Schultz reminds us, it's fine to stand up for what we believe. But what we sometimes forget when we stand up for what we believe is that the people who believe differently are still human beings like us. When we dehumanize the people with whom we disagree, we are dehumanizing ourselves. And we erode any possibility of finding common ground, breaking down the barriers between us and recognizing that common humanity. So much of our public dialogue takes place at this disrespectful level, this dehumanizing, turning the other into the other with capital letters, that it can be startling to hear people interacting differently. I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was around election time, because I think the participants were discussing the debates leading up to the presidential election. And this was Radio Times on National Public Radio with Marty Moscowane. She had a Democrat and a Republican on the show, and they were in dialogue with each other. And they were making really vigorous points and, you know, not quite pounding the table, but you could tell they were passionate about their perspective. And one of them would speak passionately, and then the other would say something like, "Well, now that's a very good point you're making. I see where you're coming from. Now let me explain to you why I see it differently." And they'd pound the table and say something passionate. The other would say, "Okay, all right, I hear you, but let me point this out." And it went back and forth like that a few times, and I was finding the whole experience very strange, and I couldn't figure out why. And I finally realized that what I was experiencing was a sense of shock at their civility to one another. And then I was really sad that civility had become shocking to me in public discourse. Now, the events in France this week have reminded us, as if we needed reminding, of how dangerous hatred is. And of course, we don't need to look beyond our own national borders to see how easily dialogue breaks down, how easily we can demonize people who are different from us. Vonnegut spoke of the failure to love leading to dislike and then to hatred and then potentially to violence. But I think he missed a step in there. And if I were giving his talk, which I now have the luxury of doing, sorry, Kurt, I would add the element of fear. I think when we fail to see our common humanity with others, it's easy to begin to fear them. And it's out of that fear that we begin to develop a sense of dislike and hatred and even violence. Now, certainly I acknowledge that there are extremists out there on both sides of every issue with whom it is impossible to have a rational conversation. And we've probably all tried and had that experience of being unable to form any kind of connection. But those aren't the people I'm talking about. Although even there, we have to find a way to recognize our common humanity with those people. But when it comes to actual engagement, I'm talking about the vast majority of people in the world. All those people out there who love their children and love their country and love their God and take good care of their pets and work hard and give to charity. You know, people just like us. Whether it's politics or religion or any other issue, we have to stop demonizing whole groups of people because they hold different views than we do. Because it's one thing to hate an idea, and it's something very different to hate the people who hold the idea. People of goodwill can see things differently. We don't have to love them. We don't even have to like them. But we've got to find a way to respect them enough to avoid that slippery slope that Vonnegut describes. Now, I've been talking about this as a national or even a global issue, and I think that's the context in which Bill Schultz wrote his words about building a world with people who are different from us. But I want to bring it a little closer to home, because that's where we have the greatest influence, in the smaller spheres where we each live every day. In my Mennonite church, we light a peace candle every Sunday and remind ourselves to be peacemakers in our homes, in our churches, in our communities, in our world. It starts at the smallest level. I love the words that ended our reading from William Sloane Coffin, that religious people should be notorious boundary crossers. I think that's true, but that part of our job as religious people is to reach out across boundaries, through the barriers, to the people on the other side. And I think we manage it on some levels pretty well. We get very involved in interfaith work. In fact, I think we're particularly well-suited to interfaith work. We try to cross boundaries of race and nationality and culture. We struggle continually with the boundaries of class. And we have perhaps the hardest time crossing the boundaries of politics. As Unitarian Universalists, we love to talk about welcoming diverse people into our congregations. And I think we genuinely mean that as long as they think pretty much the same way we think. We find it harder to welcome in people who have a different viewpoint than what we think of as our usual party line. We don't say they're not welcome. We may even explicitly say they are welcome. But we assume a likeness of thought, a shared perspective. It shows up most strongly around politics and social issues, but it's easy to see it in theological and economical terms also. Many people find it very lonely to be a Republican or a Christian or a working class in one of our congregations. I went through years of sadness that I felt more at home in the little Mennonite congregation I had begun to visit than I did in my own Unitarian congregation. And over my years in ministry, close to 25 years now, too many people have told me that they just keep their mouth shut because if they speak honestly, they'll be ridiculed. I do think that we define ourselves by our shared values, and that will lead to a certain similarity of thought on many issues. But even so, shared values can lead to different conclusions about how best to live out those values in day-to-day life. You don't have to be a left-of-center Democrat to hunger for liberal religious thinking. You can be fiscally conservative and socially progressive. We are not all at ease in our minds and hearts about abortion. We can't all afford to attend expensive fundraisers. And we don't all think that poking fun at Christianity is funny. And yet I have heard all of those from pulpits in our churches. When we make those kinds of assumptions, and we make them all the time, we show our disrespect. And we drive away people who need us and people whom we need. We make ourselves smaller when we do that, smaller as people in our character. And literally, we make our movement smaller by driving away people who might love to find a home with us. There's that wonderful old saying about religion that it should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I sometimes think we lean a little too much on the comfort side. We love to gather with like-minded people where we feel at home. Of course we do. We should take joy in that experience. But religion asks us to do more than that. It also asks us to reach out across the boundaries and make room for people who aren't just like us. Religion asks us to be willing to be uncomfortable sometimes in the service of deeper compassion, deeper reverence, and deeper humanity. So I try to be less concerned with whether or not I agree with someone than with how we're able to talk with each other. If I only spend my time with people who think just like I do, I never get to practice that vital skill of communicating across differences, which to me is one of the primary values of being in community in the first place. Not needing to think alike about everything, but listening respectfully and seeking to understand the differences. I want to close with words from Adlai Stevenson. One of my deepest regrets in life is having been too young to vote for him. Partly, I would have loved to see another Unitarian in the White House, but more importantly, I would have liked his attitude in the White House, whether it was inspired by Unitarian Universalism or any other faith. He wrote, "I think that one of our most important tasks is to convince ourselves and others that there is nothing to fear in difference. That difference, in fact, is one of the healthiest and most invigorating of human characteristics without which life would become lifeless. Here lies the power of the liberal way, not in making the whole world Unitarian, but in helping ourselves and others to see some of the possibilities inherent in viewpoints other than our own, in encouraging the free interchange of ideas, in urging the fullest, most vigorous use of critical examination. Thus, we can learn to grow together, to unite in our common search for the truth beneath a better and happier world." May it be so.